Welcome to Hair Metal Memories. We are your hosts. I'm Brian.
And I'm Aaron. And
we are on part three.
Here we go, people.
Of our Van Halen retrospective, the Hair Metal Influence. So,
whew.
Where you at?
Thanks for sticking it out with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and I'm sorry for anything I may have said in the last one. As I said before, you're not wrong. We just disagree. That's all. That is all. I feel like I just feel like I need to say that a lot. I'm sorry.
we're drinking Cabo Wabo.
We're having a little bit of Cabo Wabo.
Yep.
Maybe some beer made by Belgian monks. Who knows?
We're having some of that too.
We can't say.
And so we're like ready to like round out this last.
It seems like if we're going to talk about Van Halen, we should.
Yeah.
You know, maybe indulge a little
bit.
We
should Van Halen.
Yeah, we should Van Halen. So, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
Y'all know what's up. We're not smoking any cigarettes.
No.
I can assure you. Because that's...
No.
Neither of us are... Yeah. are
oh, that's
not our thing.
Yeah, sad.
Exactly. Exactly. That's my whole point.
Yeah.
And so we're not doing that.
Yeah.
Not that this helps.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, too, like on that, you know, since I feel like we're getting personal with it, talking about like Eddie and stuff like that. I saw I ended up following Valerie Bertinelli on Instagram, and her name on Instagram is Wolfie's Mom. And as we're going to see,
I get it. And
as we're going to see, like probably at the end of this episode, Wolfie is like a central figure in Van Halen mythology. But anyway,
yes,
very
much so. Yeah. And we will get there.
There's a good setup. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like that. I thought that was really charming.
Oh, no, dude, Wolfie's cool. Yeah. For anything I may feel about this era of Van Halen, I'm not picking on Wolfie at all, dude. Like, nope, dude's cool with me. He's a great guy. But that's doesn't even play into it.
Yeah, so we've covered the first two Sammy Hagar albums.
Here we go, people.
Now we're up to, it's 1991.
It is 1991 when,
Yeah.
Well, you know, okay, like I'm younger than you. So we had different things that hit our wheelhouses at different times. And I know what type of music we talk about here. But I am an unapologetic Nirvana fan, and so the whole thing is...
Yeah, me too.
This is a few months away from being, like, knocked down a whole bunch of spots in young Aaron's experience, but...
Sure.
That doesn't mean that I haven't spent a good deal of time with this album.
Sure.
And actually, I have better things to say about this one than the last two. So
me too.
So those
me
of y'all
too.
Who are the Van Hagar people, here. You know, like...
That's Aaron and I clinking our glasses. Yeah,
that was us. We can probably still find some common ground. It's cool.
Yeah.
And and that's where we're at now.
Yeah, 1991, For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge.
Came out 10 days after my 11th birthday.
Yeah. And it's another number one. It's over triple platinum. And 7 of the 11 songs were released as singles.
See, it's almost like, 7 of 11 songs. So we're getting into that sort of hysteria and thriller territory where... We've released most of this album. 7 of 11 songs.
7 of the 11 songs. That's, you know, take a step back. That's, you know.
When you think about the fact that this album is 52 minutes long.
Yeah.
Almost, like more than half of that running time has been released to radio for play. Right? That's a thing
that's
much
an
like.
An achievement.
Like
know?
A hysteria, or you could almost see like a Bryan Adams record doing some shit like that. But
yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah, yeah. Also, the return of producer Ted Templeman, which we cannot, you know, understand enough.
I didn't even think about that when I was like, you know, I actually kind of like this one a little better than the ones before it.
Yeah, yeah. Same. This actually was a turnaround for me. Like this one, like I was not familiar with. Like I know, like on the last episode we talked about, like 5150, I was familiar with, and I was sort of like, you know, into it, And then, like, you know, OUA 812, like, you know, was a little bit of, like, weirdness and stuff. And then I abandoned Van Halen.
See, here's the thing.
So this is a good, like, for this new episode, all of this stuff has mostly been new for me.
See, when I was seventh grade, I had a friend who had joined, like, Columbia House and maybe BMG at, like, the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And had done all this ordering and, like, doubled up on some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hey, I've got all these duplicate CDs. Do you want some of them? I'm like, yeah, what if I wanted these four? What would it cost me? He goes like, oh, you can just have them. I don't care. Okay.
Oh,
and so yeah. The first four CDs I ever owned were Black Crowes, Shake Your Moneymaker.
Excellent album.
Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusions 1 and 2.
Oh.
And Van Halen's For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. Those were my first four CDs that I ever owned. Because I was a cassette kid. You know, I had the cassette deck. And so I have spent time with this album. This was the album I was sitting there listening. I was at my parents' computer because we bought our first home desktop computer in the fall of 92. So, yeah. I mean, we're a year beyond the album, but, you know, I'm also 11 years old, so whatever.
Right. Culture moves more slowly back then, too.
Yes. Yes, it did, because this album didn't drop out of the zeitgeist for, like, 2 years and change.
Right.
I mean, right now, that song boosted it. I mean, through the first part of, like, grunge right now was still, like, a song, you know?
It was. Yeah. Yeah, Van Halen were still seemingly relevant, while that was happening.
But
we
were listening to this album. I was listening to this album on my parents' computer because that's the only CD drive we had in the house. And my dad's like, you know, technically, we could actually, like, save that music on the computer. And I was like, what? You can actually put music on a computer? He goes, now, here's the thing is that CD would pretty much take up the entire hard drive.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in 1992, you could store, like... well, nothing on a computer. And that's why your video games had like 12 fucking floppy disks and things like that. Mm-hmm. But so I actually sat around and listened to this a lot on our little computer while I'd sit there playing
solitaire.
I remember
video game boxes being super heavy because they had like 12
because they had 12 disks.
Because
it wasn't until maybe like, what, 2-3 years after this where you started getting the option to, you could buy the floppy disk version of a game or the CD version.
Like it was airy.
This would have been the first era of that. So having a CD drive on your computer was still like an optional thing. So that's my little Van Halen For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge digression for you and what I remember about this album.
Yeah, that's great.
Listening to this a lot on a computer playing freaking the tile flippy game.
Yeah. Yeah, and to me, I had not listened to this one at all. I went into it like, you know, I had abandoned Van Halen actually at this point. And
we had bet money on that, I would have lost. I assumed you knew this album like I would know this album.
No, I was into other music at the time, and
because that makes sense.
Which is weird because like going back and doing the listening through the catalog, I was looking forward to 5150 and OU812, and because
they started adopting a better sound.
Yeah, and then I felt like disappointed, but when I listened to For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, I was actually really impressed with it, and it was like because I was sort of like, oh, this is gonna be a slog or whatever.
They did seem to kind of like want to get back to like being kind of like a more rockin' band. It is kind of cool that Sammy Hagar apparently just wanted to call it fuck and just didn't even want to want to bother with an acronym. Yeah.
But censorship was a hot topic in 1991.
Oh no, it was.
So,
I remember that because I was of the age in 1991 when they announced that there was going to be those parental advisory stickers.
Yeah.
Little 11-year-old Aaron went, "Oh, so when I see that sticker in the store, I know that that's now mine to grab."
Yeah. Yeah.
Cuz you've instantly told me that, "Oh, this is good. Oh, you shouldn't buy this." So I was like, "Yeah, I'm getting that. I can guarantee you." I went to Musicland and bought Two Live Crew without. I walked up to the counter and looked behind the desk and went, "Can I get that Two Live Crew album back there?" And they're like, "Yep, sure can." I was 12 years old. They made no attempt to card me or ask any questions. I was like, yeah, sure, here you go. So, yeah, good luck with your hiding things behind the desk.
The mix on this is definitely better than OU812.
Because there's a producer back.
You can hear bass.
You can.
You know, yeah, which I like. And Eddie's layering guitars for some of the compositions, which is like kind of cool. He's not using his Marshall Super Lead nearly as much on this album.
Well, no, this is where he starts using the PV stuff.
Yeah, and the guitar is noticeably like thicker and heavier. And
it's pretty
cool.
Because in the 90s is where you start getting a lot more.
Yeah, like, the chunky
mid-rangey stuff.
Yeah. And even their vocals level up a little bit here. You know. Probably because, like, you know, they were integrating Sammy into the, you know, the vocal
chain and
Ted Templeman's
back,
like,
and he's like,
and
guys.
Ted Templeman's back and probably helping them with that. Yeah.
Because if you remember, all the cool vocal stuff we talked about before was all on the albums when Dave was still
right.
In the
group. Yeah. Yeah. And the marketing for this record was that it was a return to hard rock. And
I remember that. And their MTV talked about it because this was a saturated album on MTV.
Yeah. And there aren't nearly as many ballads on it, you know, and so it's largely successful in that
regard. And
what
weirds me out is I see that there's only three singles from this album, but doesn't it feel like it was a lot more present than that? And just like
you're right,
three,
yeah, I was surprised by that too, actually. You know, after the last one having so many singles,
But now, I know what the confusion is now, and because, you know, the thing is, you get into the era when you get to like 19, maybe even 1989, let's say, through 93, 94, where bands stop necessarily issuing singles for the radio and saying, well, let's just make a video for this song.
Yeah.
And just make it
okay.
A video release. Because there's three singles on this album, but there's four videos. And that's why I thought...
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
That song, Runaround...
Yeah.
That's not a single. But there was a video for it. I know there was a video for that song, Runaround. Right? Am I crazy? Like,
there was a video for it. I didn't know there wasn't a single for it, though. That doesn't make any sense.
I see three singles listed on this. Now, there's, like, promotional singles that were released, but as far as, like, I'm going to go buy the single at the store.
Right.
Because...
That's one of my favorite words.
That's not an outdated reference. We'll get you to bed, Grandpa, with your casingles.
Yeah. I remember even at the time going, casingle, is that really what you want us to say?
I had a casingle of Michael Damian. Do you remember Michael Damian?
I do.
Do you remember Rock On?
I do.
When he covered Rock On, I had a casingle of that.
I had that same casingle, yeah.
I loved it so much that I never heard it again after 1989.
My wife, my first wife, was a huge Michael Damian fan, and so
The Young and the Restless.
The Young and the Restless, which was her favorite soap opera. Yeah, yeah, and he did that song on the soap opera, and so she said, like, you know,
holy shit.
Yeah, yeah, and so I thought that her tastes were in,
questionable. Yeah,
but later on she tried.
I was 8 years old.
But you know, in her defense, later on she tried to talk me into watching the movie The Princess Bride.
That's a great movie.
Because
yeah.
it had her favorite soap opera actress, Robin Wright, in it.
Robin Wright was on a soap opera?
She was on a soap opera.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and that was how she knew. She knew about her. She goes like, oh, you should watch this movie because my favorite. And I was just like, I don't know, man. The Michael Damian thing, you know.
It's funny that it's just because Robin Wright for my favorite soap opera is in it and not, what's fucking Rob Reiner?
Right. Right. And then, the first time I watched The Princess Bride, I was like, oh shit, why did this is really good. Your taste is not in question at all anymore.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. It's okay to be wrong. Yeah.
Anyway, so we're talking about Van Halen, if I remember right.
Yeah. where the hell was I?
I do remember I remember watching the premiere. I watched the world premiere for the pound cake video.
Okay.
Because back then, you know, on MTV, you would get when they would say, hey, this is the first time we've played this video. Hey, look at us. Here we go. I was there when they played pound cake. And I remember thinking that song was cool as hell. I don't necessarily know that I still think it's cool as hell, but after the last two records, it's cool as hell.
Yeah, in that context, it's cool as hell. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this album is like 2 minutes longer than the last one, which doesn't necessarily feel like a good direction.
Right, but in their defense, it's more of it's more a fault of the digital era than it is of them.
Yeah.
Everybody starts making longer records.
Some of the songs are over 6 minutes long.
At least I'm seeing two of them.
Yeah.
And even, you know, I mean.
Which is, so it's definitely an indulgent album.
We're talking about a band that whose first six albums were all between 31 and 36 minutes.
Right.
And they have expanded at least 30%.
Since then. So
sometimes more than that.
So Devil's Advocate, have they earned the right to do that? I mean,
in terms of commerce, they have. Yes, they have.
Yes,
because
easily.
They're very successful. Yeah. So we're getting into the place of, I don't care for an album that's that long, but they have very much earned the right to do that.
Right.
That is fair.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. We also see synthesizers all but vanish on this album.
They get a lot more chill about things here.
Yeah. To be replaced by, like, there's some piano sections on it. And so instead of like synthesizers, we're having
pianos. All remember Right Now, everybody in the universe,
most notably on Right Now.
That's piano. That's not, I'm pretty sure it's real piano. They could afford that at that point, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. Well, they could afford it before. They just,
okay, fair. Yes. Yeah.
Lamborghinis, right?
Oh, that's right. My Lamborghini doesn't have a piano in it. Oh, wait, that, I don't, yeah.
Yeah. We also see the return of an instrumental on this album. 316.
They had shied away from them for a while now.
Yeah, yes. We haven't had them on it, which is an ode to Wolfgang, you know, again, which will be a major part of the story going forward.
It turns out it actually has nothing to do with Steve Austin and his Steve Austin 316 in WWF, which is what I would prefer to have in my head canon, but that's also because, you know, Cabo Wabo tequila. So
thank you, Cabo Wabo.
There you go.
Yeah. This was the surprise album for me. This is the
one. Was kind of for me too. I'm gonna have to say that. Going back,
It was the songs are better, I think, overall. But but the production also really helped.
It is. You know? Having Ted Templeman back was great.
Yeah.
And I have even yet another awesome story about For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, because I worked with this dude who decided he didn't want any of his records anymore.
Yeah.
And he approached me about taking them. I was like, yeah, just you float me a price and let me know what you want for your records. That's fine.
Yeah.
He brings them all in. He goes, the thing is, I don't want a price. Just take these. Just get them out of my house. I don't want a price. Just take them.
Nice.
Okay, right on.
Right.
Thanks, man. And this was on vinyl in there. And the crazy thing is, for your vinyl history lesson, for the only one you're getting for any of this, is because it was 1991, this was not released on vinyl for the general public. In the traditional sense, it was only released on vinyl for Columbia House. Or if you had, like,
really?
You know. Yeah. And this guy that I worked with, he was a member of Columbia House. And you know those Atlantic Rhythm and Blues compilations?
Yeah.
He gave me the whole box set, all 14 freaking LPs in one big box set all together that he bought from Columbia House.
I just completed my collection and then of those, by the and way. Then,
nice. Well done. That's Thank a you. Great box set, people.
It is a great box set.
We're not going to do a Rhythm and Blues podcast because we're not right. equipped to do that, but the Atlantic Rhythm and Blues box set is one of the best things you'll ever listen to in your life. Anyways, back to our normal story. there was a copy of For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge in there, and I could not believe it because that's just not one you see on wax. And I was like, you don't want anything for this? He's like, no, I just don't care. You just take it. Go home.
Man.
And, I told another one of my friends who worked at a record store that I had a copy of this. And he's like, oh, yeah, there's a guy who comes in who asks us if we ever see copies of For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. And I said, well, tell him that I have it. And I've gone and done some research into what the pricing is. And I'll be like, really cool. And I'll sell it to you for like way less than what it goes for at market because I'm not necessarily trying to.
Right. Yeah.
Be flippy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I offered it like for like
trying to get a record 45, to a fan of it,
45, 50 bucks less than they asked for it on like Discogs.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, "What's wrong with it? Why are you asking that little?" I'm like,
"Oh wow!" So he's skeptical care. Because it was too he's good like, of a deal.
Well, no, I don't want that. I don't want that. Don't even. I don't want that. Okay, so I went on the Discogs and I looked up how much it was going for and I marked it down for like twenty bucks less than that and it sold in 7 minutes.
Okay, well, I mean, well, I put good, it up and it was good. Going.
I was like, all right, dude, whatever. Yeah. I listened to it before I sold it and everything, and that was where that was actually one of the first times we started talking about doing these kind of retrospectives.
Yeah.
When we were toying around with like the UFO thing. I remember kind of thinking about Van Halen.
Yeah.
And that roughly would have been about the time that I decided to sit down and listen to this and just be like, okay, let me just go through this record and listen to it as somebody who's not really a big, I'm not a big Montrose fan. I don't care for Sammy's solo records. They're not bad or anything. Yeah. It's just really not my bag. I do like the indulgent, crazy, drunken 70s rock, just sort of different shades of it, if you will.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to hear some of this stuff. The funny thing is, I know what song I was confusing with a song on another album. I confused Top of the World and Feel So Good.
Easy to do.
And I know why I did that. And it's because they were both like the last single from the album where you get right near the end of that cycle where the next album's kind of starting to come along and everything. And they just kind of got mixed up in my head. Because if you remember, Top of the World had like a video and everything.
It did,
Because I'm pretty sure that Pound Cake, Run Around, Right Now, and Top of the World all had videos. That right?
Sounds right.
And Run Around was apparently not a single.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm thinking that means, if you went to Discogs and looked up in the singles section, that there was probably like a promotional single that was like a one song CD that was released to radio stations. I will guarantee you that.
Okay.
I'm not even gonna look. I'm just I'm confident. If you look, you'll see it.
What would you say is your favorite song off of
my favorite song on
Unlawful Carnal Knowledge? What's your favorite song?
Probably Pound Cake. I'm not even I'm sorry if that's like super obvious, but it's probably my favorite one.
It's a rockin' song.
And it kind of goes back to you know, in between OU812 and this one is where I kind of discovered the whole thing about David Lee Roth being the guy for Van Halen and everything.
The big
like shifting point in opinions about that. Yeah. And so I wasn't expecting much when this came along. And I remember like the Pound Cake video coming out, me being like, okay, all right, that's pretty cool. Actually, you know what? I'm going to change my answer right now because and I'm going to go with Right Now. And here's why I'm going to go with Right Now, because one of the funniest things I ever saw on Saturday Night Live is when...
I like where this is going.
if you'll remember, do you remember Crystal Pepsi?
Vaguely, yeah.
It's like, okay. Yeah. Crystal Pepsi.
I remember it happened,
when
yeah.
they made the clear cola, okay? Like that same...
Oh,
this would have been...
shit. Did they do a theme to that or something like that?
No, this would have been like the fall, winter 92, maybe early winter 93 into spring. When Saturday Night Live did an ad for Crystal Gravy. And it was supposed to be like a gravy that was clear like Crystal Pepsi that they poured on stuff. And they were using the song Right Now in it, and it was really funny. And so that, okay, that probably makes that my favorite song on this album.
Okay.
And it kind of makes it to where, like, even like if I hear that song on the radio, which it doesn't happen much at this point because the way streaming and record collections work and everything, I will still kind of like just giggle to myself remembering the Crystal Gravy thing. So that would be my pick.
Yeah. I'm not on a radio station that probably plays Right Now very much either, honestly.
You know, we're at a point where our local classic rock station has actually probably moved to where this album is on the later end of what they play.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, some of that classic rock and oldie stuff, it works on like a Simpsons-like sliding time scale. So so there's a good chance that, like, you know, the stuff that in the late 90s was playing like the 70s and early 80s, that stuff's like playing the 90s stuff now. So we're starting to slide past this in like a radio capacity. Unless y'all live in bigger cities that have much more robust radio than we do here. And honestly... outside of the internet, air radio seems odd to still be clinging on in that way.
Yeah,
we
need James Gunn to like include a Van Halen song with
we
Sammy
do.
Hagar on it.
We
to,
do.
Like,
if there's some
it,
superhero that needs to listen to like to listen to a Runaround or something during some key sequence, you know, pitch it.
Yeah.
But for you.
My favorite song was Judgment Day because it's I think it's the heaviest. I think it's I think it's the chugger. I'm probably going to go with like the chuggiest of Eddie's stuff. I think Runaround is pretty catchy, and Eddie's rhythm parts are really cool, and the harmony vocals on that sound really good too. Actually, that's another
they
good
do. Thank you, Michael Anthony.
Yeah, and that is a sucker punch for me. And Man on a Mission has a cool little riff in it. I dig it too. It's sort of jazzy.
I don't know how I missed this originally, but Steve Lukather sings on this record.
Yeah. Yeah, he sings on a couple of them, and like because he and Eddie were friends. I think Steve Lukather.
I guess that makes sense because
Thriller gig. You know,
that makes sense.
Yeah,
because
Steve Lukather
played on
the rhythm guitar parts on Unbeat It. Yeah. Yeah, least favorite song.
I don't know. Pick.
Your least favorite song is Pleasure Dome. That's like Sammy's most self-indulgent thing that he ever does.
See, I mean, that was kind of my pick.
Yeah.
Just because the thing is, it's a long enough record that it really has some saggy bits.
Yeah, it does.
And the thing is, Pleasure Dome is like 7 minutes long, and I don't even hate long songs or anything. It's just that there's seven minutes that are kind of like, I don't think you thought all 7 of these minutes through, or you're just rich enough that your producer's going to be like, hey, you do what you want.
Yeah.
It's not like the 70s where you would just get super, super, super stoned in the booth and the producer's like, you just go, man. Yeah. You know?
Van Halen's not that kind of a band. Yeah.
These are the 90s. This is the digital era. This is the mega conglomerate, huge label era. You know, we're beyond all that.
Yeah. We need more songs with less content.
You know, back in the 60s, your major labels would just be like, hey, you just go do whatever you want. No. We don't care. We'll put it out. Enjoy yourselves, especially if it's like Warner or Elektra or something. Yeah. You know, I mean, this was Warner, and that might actually play into the huge budget.
Sure.
There's no way this was a cheap album to make.
No.
And it's not even necessarily because of, like, effects or orchestras or anything like that. It's just that, like, it's Van Halen. It's 1991.
Right.
And we're talking about this is being made before anybody knows that any other music is coming along that isn't
Yeah, they were like still one of the hugest bands in the world.
Yes, they were, you know? And they still kind of, you know, they
delivered.
They do weather the grunge storm,
right?
Probably better than a lot of bands do. We're not there yet, but when this came out, we didn't know that was going to happen.
This is kind of their like stepping into line with grunge, I would say.
Which is funny because it's like 3 months before Nirvana comes along.
Yeah.
3 months.
Right.
They got to have a 3 month run.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a little bit longer than that because I think maybe the Pound Cake song, like as a single, as a video, as a promotional event, maybe preceded the album by
a little bit. Yeah. And one of the I think we should play like the solo to Pound Cake because I think it's like
we should.
It's kind of chaotic and but I think it sort of like ties into that time at the Van Halen or Eddie in he does have his finger on the pulse, I would say. So anyway, here's the solo to Pound Cake.
Crunchy,
you know, and they give him a lot of room to do stuff too, you know.
I like the fact that there's no because you know, one of the things that in a lot of the bands that we've talked about where you get to the solo section, especially bands that have one guitar player, they will do a little rhythm part and then they will overdub a solo over that rhythm part. And what I will give them is they're like, nope, we're just going to let the bass move this long, and he's just going to solo over just...
Yeah, but the last couple albums weren't like that.
And exactly.
So I think that is, again, what elevates this album. Is
yes,
like,
the space
I don't think,
that they allow makes it better.
I don't think Sammy plays guitar on this album.
Yes, he does. He is credited as a guitar.
But I don't think it's nearly as much.
It isn't. There is some kind... For an album that's longer, there's some leaner stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I read one analysis of this that says that, like, for this solo, that Eddie's playing, like, F sharp minor over an E major key, which is, like, slightly strange, but, like, Eddie's a virtuoso, and so, like, he can be, like, whatever, I'll play in whatever key you want me to play, and, you know...
Well, there's precedent for that. He was also okay.
Yeah.
Because I've read stories because he was a big Zappa fan too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
He did go to like Zappa's house and like hang out. They talked music and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Zappa was big into was a concept that he referred to as Xenochrony, where he would like
Xenochrony,
different sound.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. X Xenochrony. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
XENO crony.
I was like Z-N-O.
So like different sounds. And what it would be is he would grab like a guitar solo from one song, and just pair it with like an entirely different rhythm section that was playing in a different key.
Yeah.
But he felt that they synced up in like a time and sort of like a feeling, and then would present that as a piece. And so I can see that being a thing, and I can see that being something that Eddie like heard there. And this could be misattributing his influence here, you know?
Right.
But
yeah,
I can see how he'd be influenced by that too, because this album occurs at least 14 years after Zappa really got into the concept of using, there's a Sheiker Booty on that album. There's a song called Rubber Shirt.
Okay, yeah.
And it's Patrick O'Hearn playing bass. And then he isolated his bass tracks from some performance, and then he paired it up with a drum track of Terry Bozzio from a completely different performance, and then put them together in his...
Oh, wow, like a sound collage kind of thing?
Basically, yes. Okay. But just a two-instrument sound collage.
Okay.
So the drums and bass that you're hearing on the song Rubber Shirt were not recorded together in the same context or in the same setting.
That was in the era of tape, so that would have been really hard.
Yes, back when you would have to go sync up those tracks to make it a thing. And so the idea of taking like these different tones and then moving them together, much like you're saying there in that solo of being like, F sharp over E major, that's a weird thing to do because...
Right.
It's
tonally,
So no, I get that, and I can see how hanging around Zappa would inform some of those weird moves.
And I like the idea that Eddie was like influenced by Frank Zappa. You know, that's pretty cool.
How can you not be? The guy was amazing.
Yeah. Agreed. And I know that Eddie was a big influence on Dweezil. Because like
there's video on YouTube of Dweezil talking about like. Eddie and Frank and all that, and it's really cool.
Yeah,
and
that is really cool.
Hell yes.
No.
The last band we saw before the whole lockdown was Dweezil Zappa and his band.
Yeah, they played doing Hot Rats. Yeah.
Oh my god, that was so good. And they opened the night with Penguin in Bondage, which is a great song, I think. But yeah, so yeah, listen to some Frank Zappa. But anyway, back to this. So For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, it lasted for freaking ever.
Yeah. let's play a little bit from the Runaround solo because
fair enough.
To me, it sounds like Eddie's just having fun on this one. Actually, I think like despite all this stuff,
for all of my opinions about this era, there are a lot of times where you can tell that like they're all having fun.
Yeah.
So it really is. Yes, I don't. Maybe I'm not going to be like a big booster, but it's hard to knock a band that sounds like they're having fun. Yeah. So that always feels weird.
I think the throughput again is going to be like the story of Eddie Van Halen and whether he's having fun or not. Actually,
is ultimately the George Lucas of this whole thing.
I think that's gonna be the thread.
Well,
that
let's
probably,
listen to Eddie have some fun. Yeah,
here's Eddie having some fun. In my opinion, anyway. Final one I wanted to play was the solo from In and Out. I'm not a very big fan of this song. This is yet another one of those moments like Eddie messes around with like wah and getting kind of experimental here, and that's what I liked about it. And like, and again, his solo elevates the song. So like, you know.
Yeah.
Come on. they construct the rhythm parts during his solo.
Yeah.
But not during the song.
Yeah. They saved all their cool moves for the solo.
Yeah. After like the For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge album, they released a live album.
We're not talking about that one for too much.
Well,
longer.
This ends up being a very we're not actually gonna do anything. It was their first
live album.
It was controversial because Sammy in his biography says that they basically re-recorded everything. Eddie apparently was out of tune for some of the shows, and Alex varied some of the tempos, and after re-recording their parts, they said, "Sammy, your vocals are out of tune," and so they had to come in and re-record those. And he says he had to sing the whole thing all over again while watching the video to lip sync it up and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they do a version of The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again, which is kind of cool to hear.
I remember that being a thing.
Yeah, Eddie adapting the keyboard part to guitar was like the highlight of, as far as I can tell, the whole
album.
And
I remember there was at least like, I don't know, maybe one or two like clips from this that made MTV...
Briefly, because
by the time this comes out, we're well into
Van
Halen not being the same powerhouse that they were not more than 2 years prior.
Yeah, and I'm pretty well checked out at that point. And reading that it was like all re-recorded, it was also just sort of...
I actually worked during the summer of 94, I detasseled, and I worked with a kid who had this CD.
That's an Iowa reference.
And yes, it is.
Detasseling is when you go to corn and pull off the top parts so that the male corns don't see the female corns.
And when nobody's looking and you're 14 years old, you huddle in the middle of the field and you smoke weed. You come out the other side really fucked up because you're a 14-year-old kid.
I've realized talking to people like in other parts of the world that detasseling is like, what?
Precisely. But yes, one kid had this live album on cassette tapes and played it in the bus a lot.
Yeah.
And I did not enjoy that experience.
Sure.
Some of the songs were fine and all. Now that I understand how much of it is like, well, let's go ahead and re-record this entire thing and kill all of the stamina we have from it. That's great.
Yeah. Which brings us to 1995.
Oh, even better.
Balance. God. Probably unbalanced is more like it, right?
Full disclosure, my notes for this was a sentence that said, "Why have I agreed to do this?"
And rightly so. Okay, so this is the last one with
This went to number one.
Yeah.
So once again, before we go
and platinum.
Triple platinum. Before we go getting mad at Aaron, I understand I'm in the wrong here success capacity. Yeah. Okay. So, no offense to none of y'all who like this.
Yeah. This is the last one with Sammy. The last one with Michael Anthony. This is the first
Bruce Fairbairn produced this.
This is the first album where Eddie's sober, and he was working with a therapist who told him to imagine where he was after drinking a six pack and smoking cigarettes. And Eddie says that he wrote three songs in like half an hour after that. He says that like that was a revelatory experience for him. They toured behind this, and they called it the ambulance tour because Eddie was having hip issues and Alex was wearing a neck brace. During this is a train wreck.
The band, now, okay. The other hand, you know, you do what you gotta do to be sober. That's fine.
Sure.
I don't mean to.
Yeah. So during all this, the band's fighting a lot. Sammy and versus Eddie and Alex basically all the time. And in an interview, they said Eddie said that it got so bad that, like, you know, during his sobriety, he just started drinking again because he was like, I don't know how to deal with this.
Yep. That situation got pretty toxic. And you think about it, you know, this guy who recorded this record, man, this record isn't much better, but like, Two years before that, he recorded Get a Grip by Aerosmith, which was another one of those albums where, like, every single freaking song on the album was on the radio or in a video.
Right. So it made sense for Van Halen to work with them.
He also did The Razor's Edge by AC/DC, which, okay, I love that album. Yeah. I think that album's just wonderful. He also did Slippery When Wet, which...
Well, we have talked about it a little
bit. Y'all have probably heard that. We could do better on that one. But,
this album I had never heard either, honestly.
Oh, like, boy, I went into
this one cold. The production is pretty slick. But
let me tell you about my fucking experience hearing this the first time.
Okay.
I have relatives who live down in southern Missouri, who are all wonderful, and I love them. A friend of a friend at the time, this would have been like maybe 97, 98, and this was when, like, the car culture of having the ridiculously loud stereo system in your car with the just oppressively loud bass and whatnot was like the big thing, you know, when you would hear those cars that were like, boom, boom, you know, when you were around. Like, they had a friend who had one of those cars. Mm-hmm. And we got into the car, and I'm looking through his CD case because he just throws the CD case to me. He's like, hey, pick something, man. And I see Dr. Dre's The Chronic. I'm like, well, I want to listen to The Chronic. He's like, yeah, some of the other people in the car aren't so into rap. I'm like, oh no. So where are we going from here? And he goes, well, I have this Van Halen album. And I didn't see what Van Halen was. I just heard Van Halen. I'm like, all right, let's go. And it was this.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first experience was this, was hearing it through one of those crazy booming car systems. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, nope. So on top of it not being that great to begin with, I had to hear it like ear-splittingly loud.
Oh, wow. And so first really, exposure is
it
like...
It really just made me be like, dude, I'm sorry. No, I'm not doing this.
Yeah. The production on it is like incredibly slick.
It's really slick. Like if you were to lean against this album, you would just feel yourself like slide off the cover art because the production is so slick.
Yeah, there's a little bit of grit in it, but not much. And Eddie reportedly said that he hated the lyrics to the Amsterdam song, and I get it. Eddie's from the Netherlands, and so he probably doesn't appreciate Sammy singing about it being a party city. And in that song, Sammy references the Bulldog, which is a British themed restaurant and smoke shop in Amsterdam. my wife and I have been to Amsterdam a lot, and the Bulldog is, and it's basically like, whenever we've been there, people say like, don't go to the Bulldog. It's like the tourist place to go.
Boom.
Yeah. And so Sammy's singing about like, you know, the Bulldog. I mean, you know, Sammy's an entrepreneur and like, you know, and all that stuff. And probably,
he
you know,
knows how to market. Yeah. We can't take that away from him regardless of opinion.
Yeah. What's your favorite song off of Balance?
Is there a way they can all tie for last? You know what?
Yeah.
I'm just going to say The Seventh Seal because I like the Ingmar Bergman movie by the same movie.
Yeah.
Same name.
Yeah.
So we're just going to go with that, even though I'm...
There's a lot of production on that song that, is the one that it seemed like they wanted to have be the single.
Well, you know, you still got to open an album with what you think is your strongest song or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know, pick something. But yeah, that probably that one just because I like the Bergman movie. Yeah. I tried, man. Like I went.
You did. You
through
did
this again. Yeah. For yeah. This and yeah. Just, yeah.
Me too. Me too.
Oh boy. And
my favorite was Doing Time because it's the one that Sammy isn't on.
Also very fair.
And Strung Out.
If you feel better, the one that was issued in Japan has more songs on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're losing fans on this one, aren't
and
we?
I like the,
we're totally shitting on some album that our fans are like, dude, fuck you, man. This is no.
There's some good points here. There's some good spots.
We have crossed the Rubicon now.
No, there's some good spots. It's just it's the Cabo talking.
It is.
Yeah. We've got you know. So what's your least favorite song, I guess?
Yeah. Oh, definitely Can't Stop Loving You because it was the most present of them.
Oh, yeah. Okay. For me, it was Big Fat Money because it just feels like dumb. You know?
Like, can't argue that.
I like the frantic pace of it, but and Not Enough is like the piano ballad that nobody asked for or wanted. But it feels different to me, so I give it some points for that. That song, Feeling, you know, was not my favorite.
And, you know, sometimes it's like, sometimes with these crazy rocky things.
And it's
things,
over 6.5 minutes long. It's like,
and some of those topics, it's like, you know how after We're Not Gonna Take It, like Dee Snider's, he's like, I can't write this song ever again. Like, this spirit that we capture on this record, I can never do ever again because we're, like, rich now. And now I have my own pool, so I can't write an angry song now.
Right. Yeah, if you're not hungry, you can't. It's hard to write an angry song.
We're past this band being that, and so a lot of it is going to start sounding kind of like more like that's great. Yeah. Okay.
And as much as I hate the song Amsterdam,
why don't we get a taste of it?
The solo, sure. I think. Again, there's a grindy groove and there's some cool guitar shit on it. But, like, you know, yeah. And again, Eddie elevating.
I see Steve Lukather in the credits again.
Yep. A great guitar player.
Absolutely.
He just really needed a good band, you know, to like really.
You know, we're well into that thing where there's plenty of bands that we love that make albums we don't like, and it always feels weird because you're like, okay, there's always like cool things on them still, because there's still that band that you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's nice to have the little moments, but you're just.
Yeah. I also want to play the solo from Aftershock because there's no rhythm guitar on this one, which is like sort of like a rarity in like the latter day Van Halen stuff, which makes it feel kind of like
the solo that we heard in that other tune the previous album where there's just no bottom guitar. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
We'll be right back. And on the completely opposite end, one of the things that was a nice surprise for me was hearing the Strung Out on this album. To me, that so Aaron and I participate in this weird noise band called Spare Mondays that we get together and we just do whatever we want. And there's an album, there's a song on this Van Halen album that sounds like that to me. And it shocked me that they were allowed to
do that. Interesting point.
And so I want to play just a little bit of that because this is the most unexpected thing you would ever, want or think about from a Van Halen album. But I really it made me take a step back and go oh wait, they're doing something cool, so. I mean, that's not very Van Halen, right?
No, this is definitely markedly different than anything from.
Yeah, I'm surprised this exists. Yeah, and just a section of it, and then on the opposite side, just as a compare and contrast kind of a thing. I wanted to play the solo from Not Enough because I think this is the most normal guitar solo that I think Eddie Van Halen's ever played. And to me,
the most normal guitar solo.
Yeah. And to me, that stuck out as
I'm
being
curious as to
weird.
What that means within the Eddie context.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's have this.
I mean, that's My Guitar Gently Weeps, right?
It is a lot more yeah, I hear what you're saying as far within the context of an Eddie Van Halen solo. It's a lot more.
It's one of the few times that his guitar solo does not elevate the song, actually. It doesn't detract from it or anything. It just it's perfectly competent and you're competent. And everything,
and
the combo's kicking in.
One of the funny things about this entire era is we're from Iowa. I completely forgot that they had a song on the Twister soundtrack.
Oh, that's right.
Two songs on the Twister soundtrack.
Yeah.
At least one on the soundtrack, one on the score.
Yeah, one of them was on the Greatest Hits compilation.
It
that was
on
the
Greatest Hits compilation.
Yeah.
And, because that movie was filmed here because that's...
Yeah.
We have...
Part of it.
We have tornadoes and potatoes.
Yeah.
yeah.
I actually have a story about that.
Oh.
I was at one point, I was working for a company that wanted me to deliver this envelope to this building on the Iowa State campus. And,
inside this envelope.
Yeah. I have no idea what was inside the envelope, but I was assured it was important, and I went to this building and all of a sudden these guards descended upon me and they said, and I looked in and I got to see Bill Paxton was sitting at the desk. The WHO station.
WOI
station here.
On the ISU campus.
Yeah. Yeah, and I assured the guys, I was like, I'm not trying to get in or anything like that. And they were like, this is a movie set, you know, we're trying like, to
no,
do
I know, and I was told to come here with this.
But I did get to look in, and I saw Bill Paxton sitting at the news desk, and like, you know, and he was like talking and looking up and stuff and holding. So I'm assuming they were filming.
Oh, wow, you know? That's cool.
Yeah, you know, but I was very
My grandfather was the chief engineer at that station.
Oh, nice. Until
the university sold it.
Yeah. Nice.
But Twister and Van Halen were here.
Yeah.
Now, see, the other thing is, the cool thing about 1996 and Van Halen is then for like 4 minutes, we get not sucky Van Halen.
Yeah. Yeah. After doing Balance, they put out a greatest hits collection.
Yeah,
it has the Twister song that's included. And Sammy gets mad about the compilation.
Blah. Because, don't care. Goodbye. Yeah, so long.
And it's the last straw. And he leaves the band.
Because we get Me Wise Magic.
Yeah, and then they work with David Lee Roth again and record two new songs.
And they're awesome.
Yeah, and then they have a public fight and break up again.
Very shortly after. I remember I did tape watch multiple times that MTV Music Awards, I believe it is, where Dave shows up with them again.
Yeah.
And they have like their just tiny little brief window of like, hey, look at us being a thing again. And I was so happy.
I was so happy too. And those two songs did kick ass.
Fuck yes, they did. Those were great.
Can't Get the Stuff No More and Me Wise Magic. Those songs kicked ass.
Wasn't there a video for Me Wise Magic?
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
I was pretty sure I saw that on MTV.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to have them break up again so quickly was just sort of like, God damn it.
Yeah, that was pretty crushing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, humans being is, I mean, even within the context of what we've gotten from them was not me.
And those two songs are the last lineup of the classic Van Halen
lineup. It is.
Lineup.
It's done after that.
Ever.
That's it. It gets much more fractured.
Us to...
The cart has jumped off the rails, people.
Van Halen 3, 1998.
Oh, my God.
They go 3 years between albums. And then they get Gary Cherone as a singer.
I feel so weird about this album.
Which, on paper, it seems like an amazing
Gary Cherone,
idea.
Man. I think Gary Cherone is a fantastic vocalist.
I do, too.
And everybody else in this band, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah. But here is part of the Eddie thread that I want to pull.
I remember you saying this, and you know, Michael Anthony's only on 3 songs on this record.
Exactly. Eddie kind of grabs the reins on this because he's just fired Sammy Hagar. He's just hired Gary Cherone, and he does a lot of the production here. Along with Mike Post.
I was just going to say, is this the same fucking Mike Post that is...
The TV theme song guy, including...
Hill Street Blues, right?
He also did the Rockford Files, which is one of the...
He did the Rockford Files.
Which is one of the greatest theme songs ever.
James Garner, we love you.
Yeah. You know, I get the attraction, actually. You know, if I met somebody who's like, oh, I worked on the Rockford Files theme and the Greatest American Heroes and stuff like that.
I have his single for Hill Street Blues.
Yeah, and Hill Street Blues.
I have that 70s single.
That seems like a pretty good, but at the same time, it's also like this pop sensibility thing. Eddie ends up playing bass on all... But the 3 songs.
Yeah.
And Michael Anthony later says that like his bass lines were dictated to him by Eddie.
Yeah.
Which isn't a real great. And then it's basically Eddie's solo project now.
And it's almost 70 minutes long.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just keeps going.
It's the longest album in their discography.
And it's just so frustrating because, yeah, you know, it's as we said, I like everybody involved in this. Mm-hmm. I really do. But none of these pieces.
I remember when they announced this, and it was so exciting.
It was exciting. It really like did seem like a really cool idea. Yeah. Even me, who was like way into like punk and shit by the time this was announced as being a thing, I was still kind of like, no, man, I'm with this. You know, like I think this is cool.
Yeah.
And.
But instead, the critics savage the album.
Shit.
It's their first album to not go platinum. It didn't sell well. They had and the band at the time were like they thought they were grooving.
They really thought they had something.
They were writing songs for a follow up and shit like that. But that was quickly abandoned after it was released. So, is it any good?
No,
not really.
It's,
I feel like actually
I don't even know. Like I mean, maybe of our like 10 listeners or whatever, there's probably one of y'all who is down with this, and that's cool. But I don't get it.
Yeah.
And I want to get it because I like everybody.
Yeah,
like
I want to get it too.
And just boy.
Yeah. Yeah,
it
leads me to.
Do you remember when Bugs Bunny threw that super slow pitch and like three different guys like swung at it and struck out?
Yep.
That's what listening to this feels like. A super slow pitch came across the plate and y'all just missed.
I feel like Eddie's trying to sound like Nuno, honestly. I feel like Eddie's trying to play catch up a little bit with Nuno because he's got Nuno's singer.
Yeah, we're past like his window of being the big guy that everybody wanted to be like, you know, right. There's other people.
Right.
And the even kind of the funny thing about that is even by the time this album comes out with, you know, we're beyond Nuno being this guy that everybody wants. No diss because I love Nuno. I'm not even trying to like.
Yeah.
Put any hate on the guy, but like by 98
I still love Nuno. Yeah.
We were past that archetype of a guitar player, so even the thing that he feels like he needs to like be onto is already a thing that was, you know,
right
rather than a thing that is,
right?
And I mean, I'm it kind of sucks that it has to be that way, but that you know, when you're these bands that are on these big labels who have these big expectations, it's funny when you're basing what you're shooting for on something that is that far past historically where you're at now.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like when you listen to some of those early 70s Supreme singles, and it's like, you know, soul and R&B has moved way past what you're putting out right now. Not that those aren't good songs, but it makes it feel like you're clinging to something that is gone now, and it spells your demise as much as anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like Eddie's trying to prove himself as a guitar player by hiring.
Which is weird because why does he need to Nuno's feel that at this singer, point?
But I also like.
We already know that he's Eddie.
Well, yeah. But I don't feel like he accepts that he's just Eddie.
I guess
he wants to be like songwriter guy. He wants to be, you know.
And it's not that he isn't.
He wants to be pop song guy.
Well, and that's what's so weird because he was already that.
Yeah, he's already accomplished all these things.
Like he's already all those things.
Yeah, yeah, I feel like he's trying to do too much, and I think that like you know his fingerprints are all over this. There's an
8.5 minute song on here.
Right. That's the thing.
And a
6.5 minute
song on here.
Yeah.
And a 7.5 minute song on here.
The 8.5 minute song does have the best guitar solo.
Great.
Yeah. But at the same time, and there is an instrumental song on it called Primary. It's a studio production more than a showcase for Eddie. And it's sort of like, well, what the hell are you doing here? I mean, kind of a fun fact is that Extreme opened for David Lee Roth in 1991, and Extreme and Van Halen had the same manager at the same time.
Oh,
so I wondered if that's like sort of like I wonder if that's the connection.
Because you know, by this period, Pat Geary wasn't playing in the band anymore. Yeah. That Kevin Figueroa, yeah, who still drums with Extreme to this day, is their drummer. So is that the connection, or was at the time?
Would make a lot of sense.
That's
yeah.
the other funny yeah. thing. This is 12 songs. 12 right. songs at 65 freaking minutes.
It's too
Good
long.
Lord,
it's waited. Yeah, it's too long for what it is. You know, and I actually would
oh
like
God,
to say
you brought clips.
No. Well, yeah, yes and no. I was just gonna say I'm hard pressed to pick a favorite or a least favorite on this album. It's just, you know, for my taste, it's uniformly bland, I guess.
That yes.
I mean,
that's almost worse than there being a notably worst track or it's just that it's all like
and there's that
nothing sticks out. It's just this
there's
sort
that
of
last
thing
song that
goes.
Eddie claims that he was talked into singing the last song, and it's like and it's pretty bad, you know, and it's too bad. But
is it a case where you can hear Gary in the studio going, "Look, dude, I'm done, man.
No,
if you want this, you do."
Gary sings harmony with him on it.
Yeah.
And so Gary's
so
trying to help him.
Complicit.
Everybody's trying to help him, but Eddie says that everybody's like told him that, you know, you got to sing this song. You got to sing this song, and it's a bummer because, like, you know, you hear all the great vocals on Van Halen albums and stuff, and I always, but like, you know. Lead vocal is a whole different.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, it is.
Anyway, I want to play like one segment from this album. Something that, you know, honestly, this is something that shows how much it was.
Bless you for finding something, for digging and being like, you know what?
It's an example.
Here's this thing.
It's an example. It's an example of how much I think that, like, Van Halen was going to sound like Extreme with Gary Cherone. Basically, you know.
Are both still just like stupidly awesome
they
at
still
what they
can,
play.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just that, boy, man, did they serve up a flat souffle here?
Yeah, I do think that, like, there is a narrative about, like, Eddie wanting to be a creative force, and then when he's given that position, he doesn't fulfill that, you know, which is a bummer. Because, like, you know...
You know, I like Roger Waters, too, but
right,
without
yeah.
David Gilmour, you can really tell the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, he needs a foil. He needs something to
push against. You actually need somebody to push against,
But he also resents
fucking
it.
Fucking great
you know?
On you.
Yeah.
You need somebody to push against. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's
after Van Halen 3, they put together another greatest hits package.
With more new songs.
Yeah, this time with three new songs with Sammy Hagar.
That were not received well.
Yeah. Yeah. And Eddie played bass on them again instead of Michael Anthony.
And there was a tour associated with this that fell apart real fast.
Yeah. Yeah. From my perspective anyway, we get to a most triumphant.
Yes, we do. So it's actually kind of cool that after all this, we get to be like, hey, guess what's about to happen now?
Yeah. Yeah. So
we get a whole freaking, this is so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We get to a different kind of truth, which is, it came out in 2012. It debuted at number 12 It's sold over 400,000 copies, which seems like slight to me, but like that was
in 2012 numbers. That's pretty crazy for Van Halen.
Yeah, and it was removed from streaming services in 2022 because supposedly they wouldn't pay David Lee Roth and Alex Van Halen what they thought they should get out of it. But like,
well, you know, okay, God. Actually, to be fair, in a streaming capacity, I understand what they mean because, dude, streaming pays nothing when it should pay more.
It doesn't.
That. So, I mean, I get it in its way. And this album was awesome. I remember I got it right when it came out, and I listened to this like day in and day out for like several weeks.
Yeah.
I love this album.
I love this album too. It kicks ass. You know, just to give a little bit of context, they reunited with David Lee Roth in 2007, and they did the most successful tour of their careers.
Big numbers.
Yeah, with Wolfgang on bass, because they were, for some reason, they were pissed off at Michael Anthony, I guess.
And Michael Anthony, that is the thing that sucks, is that Michael Anthony... Yeah. Told people, he's like, the way I found out I wasn't in the band anymore is when they announced they were going to be touring with him playing bass. That's how I found out that I was no longer a member.
Yeah.
That's a little sketch.
That's a little sketch. That's not cool.
You know, I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he also was like one of those harmonic, like, lockdown vocal dudes.
He was. Yeah.
I don't know what the source of the friction between them was, because nobody's ever really talked about it.
No.
And I guess I do respect that in a way, because like, no, we're not just going to air our fucking dirty laundry for everybody. And that's cool.
Yeah.
But
I remember seeing Michael Anthony on the 51-50 tour, like playing. He had the Jack Daniels bass, and he had a cape, and he like kept drinking from a bottle of Jack Daniels, and he just kept doing.
Yep.
And at one point, he started playing like the Mob Rules and stuff like that. And
the Mob Rules, yeah. I mean,
he had a whole bass solo segment. Like Eddie had a guitar segment, and Alex had a drum solo segment.
Right, because it was the 80s. Yeah, everybody had their solos.
Yeah, and it seemed like sort of like Michael Anthony was like this, you know, big thing. But like, But anyway, like, so they didn't have Michael Anthony come, and it was the biggest tour of their career.
And I guess I didn't realize that.
And they got like $93 million from that tour, which is like a lot. And at that point, Eddie's not too keen on recording another album.
And I didn't realize that, you know, before they had gotten back together for this tour, that apparently after that first Best Of that had the two new David Lee Roth songs in 2000, they tried to get together with them again, and it fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get another round of Sammy Hagar with those songs from the last Best Of we're talking about. So this is like, apparently between 96 and this album, there was another attempt to do something with Dave.
They've got like an old girlfriend problem or something.
Boy, something like that. And you know, as much as you would love to say, oh, it's because Eddie and Dave don't get along. Well, how many times did they try to get back with Sammy and have a breakdown too? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So they went on this tour, and it was like the most successful tour that they've ever had. But Eddie wasn't too keen on recording an album. But Wolfgang, his son, who had been on
that's
tour,
I heard about that.
Was, and he went, you know, because he lives at that house at 5150, the studio. And so he started going down and going through like demos and stuff like that.
Yeah, didn't he basically present them with like a list of being like, "Hey guys, this."
He
is,
did. Yeah, he said like, "I got to be on tour with you, but I never got to be on album with you." And he's like, "Here's a bunch of the demo tracks that I think would like, you know, be awesome and stuff like that." And so the band started like recording like, you know, a bunch of stuff, and like, you know, he was sort of like, man, let's take some of these old demos. And they started recording music for like 12 hours a day, 5 days a week with David Lee Roth coming back in, because you know, in the meantime they'd been on tour and stuff like that, and they were going back and recording some of these demos, and they had a special edition of the album that came out with a DVD called The Downtown Sessions.
I remember watching those videos.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I've just watched them recently, and we were like talking about them earlier, where like they did all, some of the songs unplugged style. If you have not seen Panama in the unplugged Downtown Sessions, it's totally worth your time. And the interviews where they talk about like the money and stuff like that is actually worth your time too. It's on YouTube. It's pretty good stuff. David Lee Roth's charming as fuck.
Absolutely.
As always. The album got pretty good critical reception, and is widely heralded as a return to form, and for good reason, I think. I mean, it's really good.
Absolutely. You know? No, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I spent a lot of time with it when it came out.
Yeah, you know, I feel like they pick up right where 1984 left off. The lyrics are a bit more serious on this one because I thought that, like, you know, fit the time and stuff like that. So it feels slightly more mature, but it's not like too mature. I mean,
he sounds like a guy who wants to bang your sister.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, exactly. And Eddie uses a wah pedal like more on the new album than any other album, which I think is an interesting choice. I actually had a hard time narrowing down what to play out of this album.
I can see it because, well, it's also because we just went through like 30 years of like,
right. Yeah. I think this album is pretty solid all the way through, actually. Yep. What's your favorite?
My favorites are, I like Blood and Fire a lot, and I like Stay Frosty a lot because it's just, I don't know, something about David Lee Roth being like, Stay Frosty. It's like,
yeah.
All right, buddy, I'm with you, pal. It is funny because it does cross into that length that I don't normally care for in albums where it's like 50 minutes long, but it's a great 50 minutes.
It is a great 50 minutes. You know? I think they sustained it on this one, actually.
Maybe Honey Baby Sweetie Dollar might be my least favorite. Maybe.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that it's like, oh my God, we have Dave again. I'm just so happy that Dave's here again.
Right,
like,
yeah.
You know, y'all just do what you want. You do what you want. You just give us a record and I'm cool.
Yeah, yeah. I love the feeling too, actually. And I was surprised at how good it actually was. I mean, my favorite, Tattoo is like the single, but like, it's pretty catchy. And
it's funny because I remember people talking shit about that song when it came out going, you mean this is a song that was like a demo from like three decades before? That's so lame that I dug that up. I'm like, you know, all sorts of bands like do that, right?
Right, right.
Where they'll like go back through their archive and go, oh, hey, I have this thing that was kind of cool. You know, like the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up was like closing in on 10 years old when they put on that record.
Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It was a song that, like, Mick Taylor was on back in the day. So, like, you know, bands do that stuff where there's, like, some old ass song that they dig up from their personal memory or from a demo they cut. Yeah. So, we get down on people for recycling old songs,
and Van Halen more than most. Stuff. You know? Well,
sure. Why not? Because they still, we know that there's a lot of old Van Halen from, you know, the Gene Simmons days or from the Outtake days where those songs just didn't get issued. Yeah. So whatever bootleg version we know is non-canonical. So if they decide later on that they want to take one of these songs and make a song out of it, well, that's well within their rights.
Yeah. I think Tattoo is pretty catchy, and She's the Woman is heavy.
That's one of the ones that kind of makes me think of like that really makes me think of the old school Van Halen.
Same.
She's the Woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Bullethead is pretty. Bullethead hammers away, and it has the album title in it with the lyrics. Honey Baby Sweetie Doll is also like very heavy, which makes the title's surprising to me. You know, you read a title like that, "Honey Baby Sweetie Doll." You're expecting
not what
like,
you're expecting.
Yeah, you're expecting something like chill. You know, what's your least favorite?
Actually, "Honey Baby Sweetie Doll" might be my least favorite.
Yeah.
But I still thoroughly enjoy listening to it.
Yeah.
I sometimes have partiality issues with Dave because I just love Dave.
Yeah, I get
like,
it.
Like, I bought Your Filthy Little Mouth on vinyl,
mm-hmm.
which is an expensive record because I just like Dave that much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes it's hard for me to pick Dave songs that I'm like, well, I don't know if I like this one because I like the guy. The universe needs a Zaphod.
I like Zaphod. Dave a lot too. Yeah. And I would agree. I think like Van Halen needs a David Lee Roth. You know, basically. You know,
just it helps strike that balance that is probably why we all fell in love with Van Halen to begin with.
Yeah. What's your least favorite song?
What's that?
What's your least favorite song?
That was the one. Yeah.
Okay. I think Outer Space is probably like the least memorable one for me. But I still like it, you know?
And also, you know, part of the problem is we're talking about a 50-minute album.
Right.
Which is like 20 minutes
longer
than like a lot of the albums that we're freaking out about from the 70s.
Right.
And into the 80s.
Yeah.
So you've added 2/3 more album to it.
Right.
And sometimes what it is, it's like, okay, I like Helloween a lot. They got back together with their original vocalist and one of the original guitar players to have like a 7-member mega group with both lead singers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they made an album that was a self-titled album called Helloween. And literally all the songs on it are fucking great. But the problem is it's a 66-minute album. So you just get so exhausted by it that it's like, okay, you know, even the songs that are good, I'm having a hard time like getting into at this point because like this album just keeps going.
And right. Yeah, it gets to be too dense. Extreme 3
is a really good example because I don't think there's really any bad songs on it.
Right. It's just
that you
could
have made 2 albums here. Yeah. There's 2 albums worth of stuff here.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think about how there was like that many years of gap between albums and their discography, it's like, well, you could have had 2 albums out. But you made one, and you made it this long and this much later.
Right.
And the problem there for them, because by the time that Extreme 3 came out, their time as like the More Than Words band was gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, by far.
A whole other. They could have had at least one more album, theoretically, maybe out before their ilk of bands were swept away.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very generous, I guess, that we get like this much Van Halen. At the end, you know.
So at least, at least their story ends with a record that we're like happy to have exist.
I'm super stoked about their last album. Actually, I think it's great.
There's a lot of bands I like where you it's not even an issue of was their last album good. It's was their last 20 freaking years of albums any good?
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of the times the answer is no.
Yeah.
I mean, as we've established, we've talked about Motley Crue on this, and I love Too Fast for Love. And there's a lot of their stuff I love. Is there stuff they've made in the last, like, really, really long time that I love? No.
Sure.
It's just not that I don't begrudge them the success they've had since then. That's fantastic for them, but...
Yeah.
You know, I read The Dirt. They freely admitted that there was a point where they were like, hey, we only need, like, 1 or 2 good songs on this record to make sure that we have
a
platinum record.
Which is what the labels were telling them at the time. Yeah.
Wasn't just Motley Crue.
Give us a couple singles.
We're more people beyond that.
Yeah. We don't give a shit about the albums.
They're a good highlighty example for it.
Yeah.
And you know, that feeds into the whole weird way that the major label machine ends up being a thing that can't sustain itself. which is a separate argument from what we're going on here with our Van Halen. And you know, we only get like one more Van Halen record after this.
Yeah.
And it's a live album. And
Let's play some stuff from this.
We should play some stuff from this, from our nice, awesome.
Yeah. I had a hard time narrowing stuff down. So, like,
I'm curious because I actually don't know what you have nailed down for this one.
I'm proud of myself for only having like three. So, like, but here's a. I wanted to play the She's the Woman solo because, like, it kicks ass. She's the one man. She's the one man. That's a lot of what Eddie does best, I think.
Hell, yes, it is.
And then the Chinatown solo. I think that's another... Ooh,
tasty
that's another
choice. Doubled up bass with the guitar there at the end of the
right, line. yeah. It's like the reclaiming the former glory, and the other one is like the as is solo, which is it's kind of like Eruption, but like I don't know, I really like it. Don't say
by progress. As is
super chunky going into that clean guitar.
Yeah,
too.
Right. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool. Yeah. So after this album, which again is amazing, and you should totally listen to it.
Like, absolutely. But you're gonna have to buy it. You can't stream it, as we've covered.
Yeah. They Alex and David Lee Roth got into a royalty dispute and like about it, and so like it was removed from streaming services. So. You know, go buy a copy. It's totally worth it.
Absolutely.
In 2015, Van Halen released a live album, the Tokyo Dome Live in Concert, with the DLR, you know, and Wolfgang lineup. And it's the only live album with him. And it's pretty good, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I listened to it a little bit, you know. I thought it was amazing. And then, of course, Eddie sadly died in 2020 from complications from throat cancer. And Wolfgang, like, announced that the band was no more after that. He said, like, you know, how can there be a Van Halen without Eddie Van Halen? Which is a good point.
And there had been like the idea thrown up that maybe they would do like a tribute or something. Yeah. I guess Alex, and part of it is Alex is just like, I just don't want to play anymore. If Eddie's not there, I just don't even want to play.
Yeah. And which makes sense. That's fine.
I won't knock that at all. That's totally cool.
Yeah. 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 Why would he really?
Nah,
a lot of ways. Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen was awarded three patents related to guitars. Folding prop to support a guitar in a flat position, a tension adjusting tailpiece, and an ornamental design for headstock. Which, I don't know. Bastard was a
thing.
Yeah, complete innovator all the time. And, you know, I didn't know he'd registered patents and stuff like that.
I did not know that either.
Yeah.
He was also, he appeared, I believe, on a Black Sabbath track somewhere in the mid-90s there on an album that nobody really wants to listen to. And hopefully, well, it actually just got remastered and re-released this
weeks ago.
I'm going to forget the name of the album.
I mean, how can I not hear?
We might have a listener who remembers it.
Yeah, Eddie Van Halen with Black Sabbath. I can't imagine not one.
It is Eddie, and it is Sabbath. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening.
Thanks for making it through with us. This was an endeavor. We didn't talk about the live videos or anything like that, and we're not going to.